Welcome to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Michael Cardoth. Now, Michael grew up on the Jersey Shore, which we're going to hear a bit about in today's conversation, received a degree in music, which we're also going to hear about, from Princeton University, and played the drums professionally for a number of years before focusing on fiction writing. He received an MFA from Ohio State and a PhD from the University of Missouri, and for 15 years, he co-directed the creative writing program at Mississippi State University, where he was awarded the John Grisham Master Teacher Award, the university's highest teaching honor. He currently lives with his family in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Michael.
Thank you, Monica, very much.
And the book that we're talking about today is, looks like maybe your fourth published novel. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Fun that City is. Heist. And you've also published a story collection called One Last Good Time and a nonfiction book, The Art and Craft of Fiction, A Writer's Guide. So Fun City Heist is set on the Jersey Shore, and the protagonist is a drummer. So how autobiographical is this? Although, of course, I'm pretty sure you didn't carry out a heist, but
yeah, my heist experience is pretty small, but the plot is all fiction, the characters are all fiction, the milieu is certainly borrowing from things that I've experienced or things I knew. I'd been coming off some writing that involved a lot of research, and I really wanted to write something that wouldn't be as steeped in research, that at least involved the kind of fabric and details that I knew about, so I could spend more time really getting invested in the story. And so, yeah, the milieu, the Jersey Shore, the rock band, the interpersonal dynamics and the details and things were certainly elements that I knew about and had lived.
So you were... I'm assuming in some bands. Were you in any bands and the name of the band here is the
Sunshine Apocalypse. Sunshine
Apocalypse. And we there's a band here in Fairfield called the Apocalyptic Tantric Apocalyptic Boys Choir, I think is the name of it. So Sunshine Apocalypse almost made it. They charted. One of their songs got pretty high up in the Billboard Top 100. Did you have that experience in your band days?
You know, I think one of the things that I was interested in is, and the nature of your question sort of exemplifies this, is that I think in the abstract sense, we have this, we think of it in terms of did they make it or not. And in reality, there's so many gradations of that. And so this, I think to an outsider, they would think, wow, this band did make it. I mean, they had a record deal. They had a song that charted, you know, people would hear it on the radio driving in their cars. And I think by any objective measure, they made it until you compare it to the next band that might have been, you know, that did even better or that may have gotten enough money to record it again or to keep going. And so... So my own experience is like, take their experience and notch it down one or two. So we recorded and we played and we charted on some college radio. And what we learned was being number one in Oneonta, New York, did not propel you to the next level. so, you know what I mean? So I think that question of like, what does it mean to succeed in a artistic medium? And what does it mean for the future? That was very much on my mind as I was working on this.
So now when you decided maybe at some point that the band wasn't going to become a lifelong career, instead of going and getting a normal day job, you turned to fiction writing.
Joke was that I was like one of the only people to say, hey, mom and dad, I'm going to go back to school for creative writing. And their response was, oh, good, something safe. So I know in any kind of objective sense, it wasn't a really practical move. But from where I was coming from, it was the most practical move I could think of. And also what had happened was even like in my 20s, while I was playing a ton of drums, I was always reading a lot. you have a lot of downtime, you know, when you're playing music. And I was writing a lot of stuff. I started writing my own stories and things, and I really liked it. And one of the things I liked about it so much was that, unlike music, you didn't need other guys. You didn't need a sound man. You didn't need a stage. You didn't have to worry about getting people into the club. You didn't have to, all you needed was like your ideas and some paper or maybe a laptop computer. And I really liked being able to do that. And so I just got more and more into it, and then ended up going to grad school. And I figured I would go and spend a couple of years obsessing about this thing that I was interested in, and then go back to New Jersey, I guess, and get a job doing something. I hadn't really thought it out too much. And then kind of midway through, I was like, wow, my professors have really good gigs. And so that was something that sort of crept up on me a little bit. And so that's why I went on for a PhD, because, you know, I hadn't been an English major. I didn't feel cooked yet. No one was going to hire me to teach college. And so I went on and got a PhD in creative writing too. And then after that, just kind of kept doing it. And so my wife and I, we met in grad school. And we ended up going down to Mississippi State, for at least 15 years. And so things kind of unfolded that way. It wasn't exactly super planned out.
Well, I think it rarely is. But it's funny you say, unlike music, you don't have to get people into the club, but you do have to find a way to get your words in front of readers who will pay for it.
Yeah.
Which isn't that, in a way, just as hard?
Yeah, it's hard in a different way. And it is... It's similar in a lot of ways. I think when I started publishing my fiction, like a lot of writers, I started publishing them in literary journals, you know, short stories. And the thing about that is, which I kind of liked, is that they're very pure. You know, literary magazines aren't making money, right? A lot of their staff is volunteer. You get paid almost nothing, or in copies, or a little. And they choose the stories because they like them. They're not thinking about the story's commercial potential. Mm. And so I kind of like the purity of that, you know. So that's kind of how I got into publishing. And it was a while before I had a novel. And yes, then I guess, you know, editors are looking at commercial potential as well as just whether they like it or not. But that was pretty far. By then, I'd been doing it a really long time.
So what was your first novel that you published?
My first novel was The Three-Day Affair, and that was 2012, I believe.
Okay. And was that the first novel that you wrote?
No, it was not. Well, I wrote an absolutely abysmal novel in my 20s. Okay. I don't even count that one. It's like, and then my thesis for my Master's of Fine Arts was my other rock and roll novel. That was the faux memoir of a heavy metal sound man. And, you know, there was some good parts about it. And it was decent, but it didn't get published. And so that was like my unpublished novel. Although I will say there was one scene from that novel that ended up in this book, which was very satisfying.
You know,
23 years later or something like that.
Can you say which scene it was?
Yeah, I totally can. In fact, I wrote a little piece for Writer's Digest about that.
It's
you can find it online. But yeah, it's chapter 4. It's the scene where the band broke up. It was their, you know, where they hit rock bottom. And I, you know, in writing this book, I needed this story where the band hit rock bottom in the most awful way. And I was like, oh, I know what scene to use. And it was a scene that I had written in the original novel decades ago. And I always liked it. And sometimes every once in a while, I take it out of my hard drive and try to refashion it as a short story or something else. And it's always kind of been floating on the, you know, around. Finally found kind of the right home.
So that was where they go to the tribute band?
Yeah. Basically, they discover to their horror that they spawned a tribute band that ends up being better than them.
That's so awful. So was the Jersey Shore an especially ripe place for rock bands in your youth?
Okay, so... You know, in my youth, it's not like, you know, in my youth, it was my youth. So it's not like I was going out to clubs. But, and I think that even, you know, I grew up, you know, I graduated from high school in 1988, right? So even by then, a lot of the clubs that were really like heyday clubs, I was off by about 15 years, right? All those clubs, Asbury Park and all those clubs in that area, which is right where I was. I mean, they were still around. And I ended up playing a lot of them, but, you know, and the Stone Pony was still very much around, you know, it's still there, and it's still there, But I feel like the, in a way, like that sort of Springsteen mythology and all that kind of stuff was a little bit before. I was alive for it, but I wasn't certainly not playing music then or even going to shows then. I was just too young, you know?
Right, right.
Well, but the feel of it was certainly there, and a lot of the bars, both in this, in towns, but also like the bars in Point Pleasant and some of those towns that like the boardwalk bars and stuff were still around.
Well, part of why I ask is because, you know, I'm here in Fairfield, Iowa, which is a pretty small town, but a good friend of mine was in that milieu in the, I'd say, early 70s in mm-hmm. Asbury Park, played in a band with Bruce Springsteen's wife, Patty, and they didn't quite hit either, and he ended up becoming a chiropractor, which is a much more, what would you say, reliable day job, perhaps, than a fiction mm-hmm. writer. And some years ago, just a few years ago, they had a reunion of their band playing at one of the clubs in Asbury Park.
Yeah.
And Bruce got up on the stage and jammed with them.
Yeah, that's a fantastic story.
Isn't
and,
it?
And there's a lot of stories like that. I mean, it was a cool place in that way. You know, it was in some ways it was a lot of little small towns connected, and there weren't too many degrees of separation in a sense between people.
Yeah. And Fun City, so the title of the book, Fun City Heist. So Fun City is what kind of like a, well, it's a boardwalk, right?
Yeah.
And did every little town there have one of these, or?
No, they really didn't. A lot of the towns, it really depended if they had a pier or not. So, you know, some of the towns would just have beaches. Some would have boardwalks. Some would have boardwalks and a pier. And the pier gave the real estate to have more things built up there. So like where I grew up in West Long Branch, which was next to Long Branch, and Long Branch had a pier. And there it was a fishing pier for a while, but it was pretty big. And then they built up a giant walk-through haunted house. And then they built some rides, and it became bigger and bigger and bigger. Then it all burnt down. But and then I mentioned Point Pleasant. That was a town about 20 miles south of us that had a pretty bustling, and they still do boardwalk and pier and bars on the pier and everything. So it sort of depends. You know, there might only be a few towns along the way that have the really built up boardwalk scene. And then in South Jersey, there's some more. And where I live actually in Delaware, I live in a town that has one. So.
Okay. And do they still have the carnival games and the rides?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very much. And in that way, it's very much like a time capsule, because it looks and feels in some ways like it always has, right?
Right, right. And I, you know, you have the description of them playing some of these carnival games, and it really took me back to my childhood I was up in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and every summer at every little town, there'd be a carnival fair kind of thing. They would come and set up and have all those games. And you'd have a few rides, you'd have a Ferris wheel and stuff, but the rides really weren't the big deal. It was the games and the idea of trying to win, and the bottle ring toss.
Which looks so easy, and it's so hard. And you know it's so hard because they have the giant prizes you can win.
And as a kid, you're just sure you're going to get it. You're sure you're going to. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. Nobody did back then. Kids, you didn't take kids with, you know, $50 to spend on these things. We as kids saved up every dime we could get our hands on, so that we'd have money to throw away at these games.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's funny. I remember there was an arcade that my sister and I would go to a few times each summer, and you would get tickets, and you could save them from year to year. And we must have saved tickets up for about 5 years, and then it burned down.
Oh, you never claimed your prize. Oh. Wow. Okay, well, tell us, give us a little bit of a kind of a plot summary of Fun City Heist.
Yeah, sure. So Mo Melnick is the main character, and he's a drummer. But when the novel opens, he hasn't played in a decade or more. And his day job is to rent out the beach umbrellas and the beach chairs for people who come to the beach. And out of the blue, his former lead singer shows up and says they booked a gig at, you know, Fun City for July 4th. And And so he tries to, they try to pressure him into playing the show, even despite the band's terrible breakup. And eventually they learn that, this isn't too much of a spoiler because Heist is in the title, that the gig is more than just a gig. It's also, they're going to try to rob the venue during their set. So that becomes like the perfect alibi. So that's how the thing unfolds.
And the reason that they think it's okay to rob this venue is that the original owner had died.
Yeah, the original owner had died. The kids are going to sell the place. It's all going to close down at the end of the summer. And by the way, the lead singer who's putting this all back together is terminally ill and wants one last blowout gig before everything kind of comes crumbling down.
Plus needs the money to pay for medical care.
Yeah. And none of the other guys are very financially well set. So he's like, and this could also be a good payday for everybody else.
Yeah. So it's a great setup. How do you come up with that?
I have no idea. Okay, so I started writing it during COVID, when I had been reading a lot. You know, we're home all the time all of a sudden in 2020, and I found myself reading a lot of novels by Donald Westlake, who, his thing was writing these comic heist novels that I just loved. They were clever and smart and fun, and it was like a great like escape from all of the COVID-y stuff. But it didn't feel like a bad escape, because they were really good novels. It was sort of like my literary equivalent of why everyone flocked to watch Ted Lasso, right? Like this idea of, it just makes you feel a little better about the world and everything, you know? So I was reading a bunch of those, and I just loved just the way that they worked and the effect it had. And so I started mucking around with this idea and I'd written a heist novel. Bluff was the novel before that, which is a magician poker, you know, novel, but it's very much also a heisty kind of thing. And so I liked doing that. And I wanted to do something that was sort of expressly more comic than I had done before. One of the challenges of trying to have anything comedic in crime is that crimes are usually the worst days of people's lives. And so then the question is, how do you do that in a comic way without either making fun of the characters or not doing justice to it or making fun? You know what I mean? Like, how do you both treat the subject matter seriously, but also have comic moments and everything? And this just felt like the right story, because bands are inherently, you know, dripping in cosmic irony, and you know what I mean? Like everything goes wrong, and it just seemed like it was the right book to do that with. And I like the idea of the band trying to, you know, a band of musicians being a band of thieves. And I just thought it was kind of thematically kind of cool to try.
Well, comic writing, comic fiction is actually hard to pull off in any genre, I think. Probably the easiest is rom-com. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it really is there. I can't think of too many people other than Tom Robbins, maybe, mm-hmm. who really pull it off. I mean, who are some of your other than Donald Westlake, who are some of the people that you...
Well, I think it's been done in this kind of world before. Certainly like a writer like Nick Hornby, you know, I'm thinking about like Roddy Doyle's novel, The Commitments, has humor in it. I'm thinking another Jersey writer, Tom Parada, has written some really good comic moments. And actually he has I forgot the name of the novel, I'll have to think about it. But he has a novel, one of his early novels is about a singer, a musician. It's a great first chapter where like, I think the lead singer drops dead in his first chapter. So anyway, he's done it well. So it's been done, but it's kind of tricky, you know.
Tricky, and I think a little kind of rare, kind of rare compared to other types of writing. But do you have much background in comedy?
No, I just like, I mean, I think I've written funny stories, short stories, more than, I mean, the novels have humor in them and stuff, but it's funny. It just depends what mood I'm in. If I'm going to spend a few years working on a book, like what kind of headspace do I want to be in for the next few years? And I think from after 2020, 2021, that's the headspace I wanted to be in. And I'm kind of starting something new now, and I'm in that similar mode, which is like, what headspace do I want to be in for the next couple of years, you know?
You mentioned that you started this after coming off of a project that required a lot of research. I'm curious what kind of research were you doing?
Mostly short stories. I've been doing some short story. Yeah, I feel like as I'm working on novels, I need a break. I'll work on a story or something. And I've been just doing, you know, just some different short stories. One of them was historical from like, you know, early 20th century. And sometimes too, like if I'm writing about somebody that has a job that's something I don't know about, just in order to just make it credible, you just have to go down some pretty deep rabbit holes. And so, I like the idea of having a main character whose job I understood.
I can see that. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Michael Cardos, author of Fun City Heist. So, Michael, when you're writing a novel, how much time do you have a regular writing routine? Do you write every day, or how does that work for you?
Yeah, my routine was incredibly disciplined. And then 15 years ago, we had kids. And then my discipline, then my schedule changed. So what I do try to do is at least touch the manuscript every day if I can, you know, so I'm not necessarily blocking out the same time every day. But I don't want to lose the thread too much for too long. It's a little bit like going to the gym, where it's easier to go the next day if you went the day before. But if you miss a week, it's really harder to go back. And I know if I skip some days when I go back, it's going to be a really frustrating day. And I know that, but that doesn't mean it won't be frustrating. So I try to get to it as much as I can. It just depends. If I'm like in early phase of it and I'm still trying to figure out what the book is about or basic story, you know, the basic story, I might not even go to the computer. It might be more like, you know, writing on paper or something like that. And then once I'm pretty far along, it's much easier to sit there for a pretty good amount of time and write pages. It just depends.
So do you plot the whole thing out before you start writing?
No, I feel funny talking about my process when I only have, like, I have four books. So the sample size isn't that big, you know. I think in general, though, it's like I like to have enough of a structure so at least I can maximize the chance of not wasting the next 2 or 3 years of my life on something that's gonna, I don't want to say wasted, that's the wrong, you know, but you know, coming, I want to maximize the chances can be viable at the end. And so I want to have like the beginning, the few 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 big moments in the book that might pivot or change it. And then I, at least what I think the ending might be, and I want to know the basic character and just enough to kind of have it make sense. So if I were to tell you the basic story, you wouldn't be like, what are you talking about? You know? So if I can tell you the story in a minute or two and have the basic, you know, situation, I feel like that might be enough. And then I'll start filling in a few details, but I don't have a big outline usually when I start, because I want to still keep it open to some surprises along the way. And usually I feel like the best surprises in the books are ones that I did not plan ahead of time. They're things that, like, I might've been working on it for several months and then I'm taking a walk or I'm washing dishes and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. What am I doing? I'm thinking about this all wrong. This thing happens. And I don't think I could have planned that ahead of time, really.
So can you tell us, without giving anything away, like something that surprised you in the writing of Fun City Heist?
Yeah, the entire ending. So,
oh wow.
I thought it was going to end one way, enough that I was working on the book, and then I say I was halfway done before I was like, wait a second, I'm totally wrong. This is not at all how it's going to end. And as soon as I knew that, I knew I was right. I knew that the my own epiphany was the right way it had to go, but it was not how I thought it was going to go.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And I guess I would ask you what you thought the ending was going to be, but then that might spoil it because somebody else may think that's where it's going. And then if they know that it's not there, then...
I think the ending I had in mind was less of a big
twist.
Ending.
Less of a twist. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Which I really, in retrospect, I'm glad for, because it means that I don't think anyway that to the extent there's a twist, it's that I don't think it feels forced, because it felt like I didn't even want there to be one. You know what I mean? Like it just felt organically like, oh, wait a minute, this is not where it's headed.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Now, so you have Mo, is he kind of based on you? He's the drummer. He's really, you're a drummer.
Yeah, okay. He's the drummer. He lives at the beach. He was in a band, and then the band ended. So I guess in a way, maybe he is. I don't know.
What could have happened if you hadn't gone back to school, that you would have ended up being a beach bum, basically?
Something like that, I suppose.
But how about personality-wise?
No, I think the only thing that's similar is, I think, and this is maybe where the humor in the book comes from, is I think a lot of the humor in the book just come from his observations and way of sort of seeing and interpreting the world, and sort of seeing the paradoxes and the, you know, the facades. And I guess that is, you know, that came from somewhere. So I think that is maybe some similar things.
Well, one of the major subplots of the book has to do with his relationship with his daughter. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about her, and at what point in your writing process did you always know he was going to have this kind of estranged daughter, or was that a surprise?
No, and this is where, like, to the extent that, like, writing is often hard and frustrating and maddening, but sometimes it's fun. And one of the places it's fun is when you just write something because it's bonkers, and then you have to then it's on paper and you have to deal with it. And so I was writing the first, you know, chapter of the book, which ended up becoming the first three chapters because I kind of broke it up. But at the end, he's like, you know, doing this thing on the boardwalk, and then he spots these two teenage girls just kind of laughing at him, and it sort of makes him feel terrible and old and stupid. And then I just threw in the line, the red-haired one was my daughter.
Oh my gosh.
It just felt like such a funny moment to introduce that. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. Now he has a daughter. What's up with that? And he didn't recognize her at first. What's up with that? So in a way, her character sprung into existence just because of that line.
Oh my gosh. And so the backstory there is that he'd had an affair with a groupie, basically.
Yeah.
And who had this daughter, and who didn't want him involved in her life, but would bring her around every now and then so she at least knew who her dad was.
Yeah, she was raised in Ohio, but once a summer they'd come out and hang out for a few days at the beach, and so they'd get together maybe once or twice a summer, and that was the extent of their relationship. So it makes sense. He hadn't seen her in a couple of years, so the idea is that, you know, this
kids change a lot as a young, in their young teen years. My gosh.
And the boardwalk is, you know, teeming with people, and so he would do a double take, like, that's her, you know, that's Janet.
Yeah. Wow. And one of the funniest scenes to me was towards the end, when, you know, his daughter ends up staying with him for a little while, and he needs her to go home. And so he gets her mother to come get her, but he doesn't want her mother to think that. He wants to make sure that her mother takes her home, and so he, like, messes up his apartment and makes it look like it's a terrible place, even though he usually keeps it really neat.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
totally,
okay, that's a little extreme.
Yeah, he makes it look like just a trashed bachelor pad. So when the mother shows up, she can't believe that her daughter's been staying there, and she'll whisk her away.
Yeah, I found that quite amusing. So, Michael, why don't you read a little bit from Fun City Heist for us?
Sure. I'll just read the first chapter, which is just a couple of pages, and that way you don't need any kind of setup.
All right,
so this is chapter one. I'm kicking back on a Saturday afternoon, the seagulls singing C sharp, when a shadow falls across my face and a voice I haven't heard for 12 years says my name, Mo. Followed by advice I didn't ask for. You gotta start wearing sunscreen. Sure enough, there stands Johnny Clay blotting out the sun. I can see right away that Florida's taken it easy on him. He appears fit and relaxed in khaki pants, yellow golf shirt, and leather sandals. His hair is stylish, salt and pepper coexisting. He looks like what he's become, a successful real estate agent. A man who left Jersey, hung up his guitar, and never looked back. "What are you doing here?" I ask. His answer is an expression I used to know well, half smile, half squint, with a flash of frontman intensity, like he knows a secret or maybe all the secrets. "I missed you too, buddy," he says, and steps over to the metal shed where I rent out chairs and umbrellas by the day or week. Comes out with a chair, unfolds it, and lowers himself beside me. "God, Mo, can you believe they're actually going to tear the place down?" He glances up toward the boardwalk, toward Fun City. It's where we all went as kids, same as our parents and their parents before them. For decades, the small beachfront amusement park never changed, which was the point. Hell, there's still a U-boat ride. But the 88-year-old owner of the family operation died over the winter, and it didn't take long for his grown children to decide the beachfront property has gotten too valuable for honky-tonk nonsense. At the end of the summer, they're tearing it all down and putting up condos. "Come on," I say, "you know you'd do the same." "Wrong," Johnny says. "I keep it going forever. See, that's what I'm talking about. How at the end of the day, what matters..." "Hang on," I say. Near us, a guy and a girl, both tan and beautiful, are lying on a blanket, the radio between them suddenly blaring. I go over to them and tell them, "You gotta turn that down. There's a noise ordinance." "A what?" the guy says. "Shouldn't be my problem. I didn't even rent them anything. But for reasons I never understood, this has always been part of the job. Like it's too lowly for the beach cops and too confrontational for the lifeguards. You can leave the music on, just turn it down, okay?" The girl has propped herself up on an elbow. "No, it's not okay. And what do you care?" I feel Johnny watching from his chair, quietly marking a minus in some cosmic scorecard. But no, he's come up beside me and slings an arm over my shoulder. "My friend here, he's being kind to you. I mean, Kokomo," he shakes his head. "It's an affront to music and beach going. Mo should kick you off the beach. He really should." The couple is watching me, having decided Johnny is insane. "There's a noise ordinance," I repeat. The guy in the blanket shakes his head and mutters under his breath before lowering the volume. Johnny and I return to our chairs and expect some veiled or unveiled critique of my existence or at least my expanding gut. But Johnny always had a way of saying the thing you least expect. "I booked us a gig," he says. "What are you talking about?" I ask. "Fun City," he says, "July 4th. "Who? Who?" He exaggerates, looking around like maybe there's some other pair of former musicians lurking nearby. "Us," he says, "Sunshine Apocalypse. We played our first ever gig at Fun City when we were 16. We played early on a weeknight for $100. We never felt more like rock stars, even after we became rock stars. But we haven't been rock stars for ages. And now he's making me state the obvious. We don't," I search for the word, "exist. We'll reunite for one show," Johnny says. "It'll be like old times." But old times is hardly a selling point. Newsflash, I tell him, "I don't even play the drums anymore." Newsflash, he says, "It's the drums. It's not like it was ever that hard." He's trying to banter like we're longtime pals, but we were never pals. For a long time, we were much closer than that. Childhood best friends who'd started a band. Then we were at each other's throats. Then he left me and the other guys and betrayed us all. "Ricky's already on board," Johnny says. "Ricky needs a therapist." Our lead guitarist could never shake his kid brother role, desperate to please his three older bandmates. A seagull flies past, screaming, "Be natural." I don't seek it out. The note's just there, announcing itself. But a drummer with perfect pitch is like a blue whale who can count cards. "Ed's on board too," Johnny says. "Ed told you that?" Which means you, Mo Melnick, are the last piece of the puzzle. But none of this makes sense. For 12 years, not a peep from the man, and now suddenly he flies back to Jersey to personally recruit the three of us for a show? There's something I'm missing, and I don't know what it is, but I know what it feels like when someone's working an angle. "Look," he says, if this is some midlife crisis, I can sympathize," I tell him, "but there's no puzzle, no pieces." "Yeah, but there's no band, Johnny. Do you see a band? Because I don't." I take a breath and tell myself not to get worked up over ancient history. "You get paid to sit on the beach and relax," I remind myself, "so relax. All I'm saying is you made your decision a long time ago. I'm making mine now. Thanks for asking. Really, you look great. I hope you're great. I do, but no band," I tell him. "No gigs. Not for me. I've been done with all that for a long time." "Huh." Johnny looks distracted suddenly, like he didn't hear a word I said. "Hey, Mo," he says. "What?" "I think that woman's drowning." He points to a lone swimmer head bobbing in the waves. When you live at the water your whole life, you know what to look for. It isn't big splashing or waving or calling for help. You can do those things, you aren't drowning. Drowning doesn't look like drowning. It's quiet and not obvious. I glance over at the lifeguard, one of several interchangeable blonde teenagers with mirrored shades and a smear of zinc oxide on his nose, but he's flirting up some girl in a bikini and paying no attention. We run to the water.
And that was Michael Cardos reading from Fun City Heist. And that the woman that they save in the water become, that's actually a, it you don't realize it at the time, but that's actually an important plot point. Did you know that when you wrote it?
No, because so much of this, like, you know, you write something, you're like, oh, I wonder why I wrote that. And then kind of figure out how it, you know, how it doesn't go to waste. Yeah.
And I got to say when, and I think you can, the people listening can tell from this, your book was really fun to read.
Thanks.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. And I didn't necessarily expect to so much. So it surprised me that way.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And when you were writing, did you write it all in the same order that it ended up, or did things get moved around?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm sure I moved things around, but I don't think I moved things around significantly. I might have mucked around with where I put some of the bits of backstory. You know.
Right.
But there isn't a whole lot of backstory in here. So I think I pretty much wrote it in the order it goes, although I didn't necessarily write it start to finish. Like I think I probably wrote some later scenes before I wrote some earlier scenes, but I don't think I did a whole lot of shuffling, you know.
So when you say you wrote some later scenes, you knew they were gonna come later, but you just decided to write them now. Why would you do that? What would prompt you to want to do that?
I think sometimes I won't know if something I'm writing is necessary or is filler or is even needed for transitional purposes until maybe sometimes I'll write something later. And then I'll realize, oh, I don't actually need to set this up. It's fine, you know? And so a bit of connective tissue I might have been planning to write might not be needed. Or it might just be that I just feel like it. Like, oh, this is a fun scene and I want to get to it while it's on my mind or something like that.
Okay, so you know this is going to happen in the future in the book and you're like, okay, I'm going to write this now because I can't.
Yeah, and also I think a lot of times the impact of a scene, the effect on the reader and the power of the scene comes from the setup. And sometimes it's hard to know how to set something up until the... It's like hard to know how to plant the cause until the effect is already there.
Okay, so you write the scene and then you know how to lead up to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now the other main characters, you've got Mo, you've got Johnny, and then you've Ricky and Ed, and then
Janice.
Janice. Mm-hmm. And are any of them sort of based on any real people?
They're not based on real people. You know, I think a little bit they conform to senses that sometimes musicians might have about the different players. Like the bass player is a little more stoic, you know, the guitarist is a little more frantic. The lead singer is definitely a front man kind of personality. You know, he's the larger than life guy who I have no doubt that he was the guy that when the band was playing at the end of the gig, he would convince the rest of the band that he doesn't need to pack up the stage because it's important that he schmooze with the audience, you know?
Right. Yes.
So I think they, in some ways they're you know, like players I've met, you know, but they're not, you know, one-to-one or anything like that.
And what was the story about why Bo ended up being a drummer?
Oh, right. I put this in that he, this might have been exactly based on real life. When I was in fourth grade, we could sign up for instruments in the fourth grade. I wanted to sign up for saxophone. And the band director was like, nah, too many kids already signed up for sax. How about drums? And I said, okay. And that was it. So,
okay. Signed up for the baritone horn.
That's a good instrument.
It's a very impractical instrument. You can't actually have much of a career on the baritone horn unless you make it into one of the very few symphonies in the world that utilize it. And the reason that I had baritone horn is because we had a trumpet at home that had been my uncle's, and my brother had it. He was playing it. So I had the choice of any instrument that the school would provide for free, which meant tuba, baritone horn, maybe a baritone sax. Mm-hmm. Although usually they don't start kids on that.
They'll start on a different one. Yeah.
So maybe a bassoon, maybe, but very, very limited selection. Only the really big, expensive instruments that they did not expect anybody to go out and buy. So they had them and provided them for free. So that's how I ended up with the baritone horn. But I did like it.
Yeah,
it was a fun instrument.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you went to college, you were in a band at that point?
Yeah. I was in a few of them. I was in, like, you know, I played in the orchestra and I played in the jazz band and stuff. And then I had my own band. And so I was always playing something.
And and you majored in music. What were you planning to do with a music degree?
I had no idea, truly. I started off as a political science major, and then halfway through I changed to music because I was taking so many music classes anyway. And at Princeton, you write a senior thesis your last year. And I just thought that the reason I changed majors was because I thought the idea of spending my senior year working on a giant political science, you know, thesis didn't sound like nearly as much fun as working on a big composition for music. So. And that was the biggest difference. I liked my political science classes a ton, and I kept taking them even after I changed my major. But the independent work I got to do in music was just what was more fun to do. As far as what was going to go on afterwards, I had no idea. I mean, I applied to, and I got into Rutgers' graduate program in music. But, you know, the director was hilarious. He saw right through me. He's like, "You can come, but are you sure you want to do this?" And I was like, and my response was, "I don't know." And I opted not to do that. And then I, you know, my buddy who was, you know, in my college band, we decided to give that a go afterwards. And so we did that for a while, you know, until it made sense not to. But I think one through line is certainly I'm not a good planner, you know, like not with big decisions anyway, just kind of, you know, wing it and do what feels right, I guess.
Okay. So you joked earlier about your parents being relieved that you went back to school for creative writing. But so how did they react to you switching your major to music at Princeton? I mean, your son gets into Princeton. It's very prestigious, and you're going to be
honestly
a drummer?
They were fine. No, they were fine. They were fine with the choice of major. I think to their great credit, to their great credit, they did not view college as a trade school or a trade planning school. They were very much behind the idea of, like, take the classes you want to take, learn as much as you can. You know, the idea of, like, it's better to know stuff than not to, but not treat it like a pre-professional school or that kind of thing.
Oh, that's cool.
Which, you know, I fully support that then. I fully support it now. I know that you know, the realities are such that it's easy to say that, but you have to earn money, you know? In sort of like in the intellectual sense of, like, take the things that you want to take and go from there. I was glad for that.
I think that's great too. You know, my dad, when he went to Cornell, so another, you know, Ivy League school, and his parents, I think, expected him, because he was going there, to major in something practical. He majored in engineering. And when it was, and then he ended up having 5 kids. And when it, like, I'm one of the oldest. And when it came time for me to go to college, he basically said, "Well, you know, my parents paid for my schooling, and so I had to do what they wanted me to do. And so I don't want you to have to do anything in particular, so I'm not going to pay anything." and it's like, okay. And so with my kids, I did the, what I did is, like, I said, "I will help you in school and you can do what you want."
Yeah, 3 generations, but we got there.
Yeah. Although at the time when my kids were in school, I wasn't able to help them a whole heck of a lot, but they did okay. So
no, that's great.
So Michael, when you decided that you were ready to publish your first novel, how did you find your publisher?
Okay. It was a long, circuitous process. Let's see. Although, you know, nothing too out of the ordinary, I queried a bunch of agents. One of them took on the book. She sent it out. It didn't sell. And then in the meantime, a friend of mine who had a novel published, you know, was like, you know, you should send it to my agent. You know, maybe it's, and you know, my agent was a very lovely person and sold books, but it wasn't really selling those kinds of books. And so I ended up, you know, breaking off with that agent. And my friend sent it to her agent, who said, I'll give it a read, but was busy, like everybody's very busy. And after a few months said, you know what, I'm just not getting around to this, but my assistant, you know, read it and really liked it. And would you be okay with her taking it on? And so that's how that happened. And so it took a while. And then there were, you know, some publishers that the first agent hadn't sent it to. So this new agent was, you know, sent it to a few agents, and that's how it got picked up. And so the first novel came out, you know, and then the second and third one were a little easier because the same publisher published those. So it wasn't like going out cold. And then this new novel went out with eventually with a different agent. This is a lot of years, you know, this is over a lot of years. And so she sent it out and found a lovely home for it. So it's, you know, it's a long process. The story collection is very different because my story collection was out with an independent publisher in Winston-Salem. And I had met the publisher directly because I had a short story of mine anthologized in one of their anthologies. And so I met the editor that way. And so when I had a collection together, he agreed to look at it. And so that was done just sort of directly. And in fact, I have a second, 15 years later, I have a second story collection coming out in 2026.
Awesome.
Which is the same publisher that did, you know, Press 53 did it 15 years ago. And so same thing, you know, we've stayed in touch over the years. So I said, hey, you know, you want to look at some of these new stories. And so that's kind of fun. So that's going to come out later in the year.
So Fun City Heist is from Severn House?
Severn House. Mm-hmm.
And tell me a little bit about them.
Yeah, they're based in the UK, although I think most of their writers and much of what they do is in the US. And they're specifically, you know, at least nominally a genre publisher, although you know, they do a lot of crime. They do other genres too, some horror, some other things. You know, the books are really, really pretty. Like, I just love the covers and the, you know, the interior and the exterior. They put beautiful books. And so yeah, it's been great. You know, they, in fact, what's funny is because it's a UK publisher, they accepted the novel last Thanksgiving on Thanksgiving Day.
Oh my and goodness.
So, about a surprise, driving, we're in the car driving to my sister's place in Pennsylvania. And we get the call from my agent, like on Thanksgiving Day, being like, or the email being like, here's something. Because, you know, in the UK, it's Thursday. It's not Thanksgiving.
Right. Absolutely. Now, you're no longer at Mississippi State. Are you still teaching?
Yeah, I'm teaching at the local high school.
Interesting.
So we moved up here. Well, what happened? It's, you know, COVID changes so much, right? It changed so much. And so we bubbled up with my wife's family up here. Our kids were suddenly home and we were suddenly teaching online. Everything was online and we could be remote. And so we came up here, what we thought was going to be for a semester, and taught online. It ended up being a year and a half. By then, our kids were enrolled in school here, and we were pretty settled here. And so, you know, it was gradual because we were teaching still remotely in Mississippi for a couple of years. Meanwhile, my wife was the poet laureate in Mississippi, so she's a poet. So she was going back and forth, and So after a few years, we sort of made the move permanent, and so we're up here now.
And are you teaching creative writing in high school?
No, I'm teaching juniors and seniors, you know, English and
okay.
Enrollment, like the sort of with the local community college and things. So It's interesting. I mean, it's funny, you know, it's not fundamentally different teaching students who are a year or two or three younger than the ones I taught before, but it is sure funny they have to ask me to use the bathroom. The sort of lay of the land of high school is obviously very different, but it's been cool.
Yeah. So when you were teaching writing at college, did you, what are some of the things that you learned from that?
From teaching,
yeah.
Look, I think the fundamental thing of it is that, certainly when I was teaching creative writing, you know, whether it's the undergrads or grad students, is that no matter what level you're at, no matter how long you've been doing it, you're still hitting the basic questions are still the same questions, which is like, you know, everything from what makes this story interesting to anyone but me, to like, how do I marry the story I want to tell with the character, with the sentence level voice, and how do I start this thing? How do I end this thing? What are the necessary scenes? It doesn't matter if you're writing your second story or your 100th story. And I think one of the great and totally maddening things about writing is that, like, you know, by the time I finished my last novel, I was really good at writing my last novel. And I feel like it taught me nothing about teaching the next novel. And then you have to start again. And then by the time I got finished with that novel, I could really write that novel. And it's useless for the thing I'm starting now. And it feels like I'm always starting from scratch. And I think that's really frustrating, but also probably what keeps it interesting.
True. Of all the students that you had who were majoring in creative writing, either undergrad or graduate, How many do you think actually go on to become published writers? What percent?
I think in terms of percent, well, not counting grad students, because they're there for that, right? I'll come back to, I think for undergrads, you know, it's a small percent, but I don't think that that's, I don't think that's good or bad. In other words, like a lot of them are taking it because they were interested in it. Again, for the same reason I took political science classes, I wasn't going to be a political scientist, right? But I think it teaches them a way of looking at the world and thinking about it, and a way of, you know, learning what different kinds of characters are like and how stories are put together. And you know, so much of my creative writing classes anyways, having them read things, you know, and figure out. So it's not just the writing part of it. So I don't think they have any intention of going on to become writers. I think the ones who want to, some of them have, and some of them have gone on and published a lot and are, you know, professors at various schools and doing things like that, have certainly gone on, which is pretty awesome. In terms of grad students, certainly a higher percentage have gone on to publish, and whether they're doing it full time or whether they're, you know, but they are doing it. They're doing it and publishing and continuing to write. And you don't always know. Certainly the undergrads, the ones who I had as a freshman or sophomore, I couldn't necessarily have picked out the ones who kept doing it, because so much of it has to do with motivation and determination and things that I won't necessarily see in a semester.
Right. Does talent always out? You know, if you're a talented writer and you keep at it, do you think you will become a published author one day if that's what you want?
Oh, man, I don't know. Depends on so many things. It depends on so many things, and it depends, like, well, you go on to publish a story in a magazine, will you go on to publish a novel, you go on to there's so many different ways to do it. I do think that doggedness and determination and sticking with it ultimately is more important than brilliance, given some baseline level of talent and the ability to get better. Some writers were like, you know, they'll take my workshop and they won't listen to a single comment I make on their manuscript. I'm like, why did you take the workshop? Like, you know what I mean? So some people are not going to want to learn things because they think they know everything, but almost everybody is going to get better if they just keep doing it. And so if you have some kind of level of not even writing talent, but like curiosity about the world talent, you know, I think that they'll get better.
I think some people probably took the workshop because they wanted someone to tell them how great they are.
That's probably true.
Rather than to actually learn something.
But to be honest, though, that was pretty unusual. I think most people people take it with a pretty generous spirit because it itself slants. You
know? Yes, indeed. I remember one time early on in doing this show, which I've been doing almost 20 years, I had a local writer who said something about how they didn't let anybody else edit their book because they were, you know, basically if they wrote it, then it was perfect and it was not a well-written book whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, it really doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that the music equivalent is I can look at a drummer sitting at his drum seat with his drums in front of him, holding his drumsticks, and before he plays the note, I can tell if he's good or not, from posture, from the arrangement of things.
That's
just tell.
That's Fun City Heist, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I know.
Mo says that. Yes.
it's so true, and I think the writing equivalent of that is like the way they talk about writing. You can get a pretty good sense of things, right? And so as soon as someone's like, "Well, no one's going to teach. No one can tell me what to do." Like, I think I kind of know. Yeah. I think I already need to know.
And everybody can continue to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're, and why do it if you're not? Why keep going if you're not willing to get better, to learn more?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Michael, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We are almost out of time. Do you have any final words of advice for wannabe writers?
Oh, my goodness. Marry another writer because it's like cheating. You have someone you can read your stuff and you can talk about in the car on long car trips. But that's maybe not the most practical advice.
And they'll understand why you're up, staying up till midnight trying to finish this chapter.
Yeah, exactly. Why the laundry piles up. No, I think, the best advice, who knows? I mean, there's so much good advice. You know, just read things that you like and then try to figure out how they're done, right? I mean, that's like, take a book you really love and get a bunch of yellow stickies and stick them in there with every time there's something that has to do with structure or something that you thought was kind of cool, and just try to, analyze it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Michael. Fun City Heist. It was a fun read. And we always close with the quote. And so I picked basically a lyric from a Mick Jagger Rolling Stones song, which I think fits for this book. You can't always get what you want, but if you try, sometimes you might find you get what you need.
That sounds perfect. I'm sure we couldn't afford it for an epigraph, but it's a good one.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, and see you all next week on Writing.